Hello, this is the meeting of the Santa Clarita Water Valley Water Finance and Administration Committee, and it's August 21st, 2023. And Director Colley, would you lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance?
Certainly. Stand, place your right hand over your heart, and join with me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which stands my nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Now for the announcements for the procedures for tonight's meeting. And we'll start with this meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Treatment Plant Board Meeting Room. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may alternatively participate remotely by using the toll-free call-in number or Zoom webinar link provided in the committee packet, which is posted on the SCV Water website. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete and submit a public comment card to the administrator to help expedite this process. To participate in public comment from a computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raise hand feature in Zoom or dial *9 when I announce the agenda item on which you wish to speak. When it is your turn to speak, please dial *6 to unmute. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments, first from members attending in person and then those attending remotely. I will then ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. These will be taken in order hands are raised. The committee then comes to a consensus to move this item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoint presentations shown at tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCV Water website. And tonight we have the full committee here with us. And I will continue on with item number 2. Public comments. Members of the public may comment as items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda at this time. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in this agenda may do so at the time each item is considered. Do we have any public comments?
Yes, we do have public comment at this time. Cam Noltemeyer, you may approach the podium.
Cam Noltemeyer. Yes, what I'm seeing is just what we have tonight. My husband and I are the only ones attending. There's a partial board up there, and it's very discouraging. It's like you think you switch it down into just little things that everybody's going to forget about you. But the Alliance for Water Efficiency is the latest little grab for give everything to us and we'll take over everything. It's these things I am finding disturbing, very disturbing, because it's not going well for the ratepayers at all. In fact, it's skyrocketing, at least from what I'm reading on tonight's agenda. So I don't know how we can get this back to what it should be, but there's been a big failure somewhere along the line. And the more I hear, the more I cringe. And I don't know what to do at this point, but I'm looking into several things and seeing what we can do as a community to demand better representation, or in their looking at what they're dealing with, when it seems like we've been pushed aside as non-existent. That's my issue right now. I find it very disturbing. As you know, I've gone to a lot of meetings, and I've done a lot of this for years and years. So what I need is to see something that represents the ratepayers. I don't see it at all. And tonight's agenda is particularly scary, especially things like this. That's an alliance. But who is it for?
Thank you, Ms. Notemeyer. Yes, go ahead.
Change the order to the items.
Okay, hang on for a sec. Any further public comment?
No public comment on number two at this time.
Okay, thank you. Director Armitage.
Yes, thank you. I would like to ask for consideration of switching the order of items 4 and 5 so that 5 goes before 4, because I think maybe the result of the discussion of item 5 could inform the discussion of item 4.
Okay. Any objections to that from the committee members? No? We can do that. I have to make my notes. Please do, Kathy. Thank you. All right. Item 3 is is presented by Rochelle Patterson. It's an investment advisor financial market update.
Yes, I just, we have online Elena Sampson from our investment advisor firm, Chandler Asset Management. And since this is the fourth quarter, part of their service is to provide a economic overview and the agency's portfolio performance report. So I will introduce Elena for a short presentation.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for having us. I also have my colleague, Mia Correll Brown, here as well. Oh, thank you, Rochelle. I see that you're sharing the screen. I was about to do the same. So if we can get started, the big story, if we turn forward to page 4, please, is that the Federal Reserve has been raising rates at a very rapid clip, really to be focused on tempering inflation. And during this time, there's also been several notable geopolitical and economic events in our world. Three things I would like to point to. I'm on the first bullet: Russia invading the Ukraine, the banking turmoil that we saw with Signature Bank, Silicon Valley Bank, and Credit Suisse. This happened in March of this year. Back one slide, please. And I'd say notably, the agency did not hold any of these banks, so that's very important, but they did have impacts on the overall market economy. And the third point was the debt ceiling debate that took place in May of 2023. Against this entire backdrop, the Federal Reserve raised rates again to a range of 5.25 to 5.55%. This is the highest range that we've seen in 22 years, and they left the option open to raise rates yet again. This has resulted, on the third bullet point, in short-term yields being higher than long-term yields. This is called an inverted yield curve. And this in the past has been a very strong predictor of recession. Now, with the debt ceiling resolved until the next presidential debate, despite many traditional indicators signaling that recession could be forthcoming, the solid labor market and the resilient consumer is indicating that this time seems to be different, though that is famous last words. It is the view of Chandler Asset Management that the Fed is near a pause and will maintain higher rates for some time. If we could go to the next slide, please, to show the labor market. And from an employment perspective, as I stated, the labor market is strong, but we're beginning to see some slower signs of growth in job gains. This is still a very resilient number with 187,000 jobs in July. The beginning of the year, we were seeing something like 250,000 jobs being added every month. And on the right-hand side, you can see the employment rate. This continues to be rather strong at level, a range-bound levels between 3.4 and 3.7%. The natural unemployment rate is often considered between 4 and 4.5%. So that's part of what people are saying is very strong with regard to labor. And finally, I would comment that the higher wages that people are realizing, both on a nominal and real basis, meaning inflation adjusted, is really helping the consumer help support their sale, the retail sales. We're out there shopping. We are a nation of shoppers. To the next slide, please, on inflation. Now, the positive news that you can see on the left-hand side is that we've gone down quite precipitously from the July 2022 numbers of headline CPI being at nearly 9.1%, and that has declined down to 3.2%. This is what many of us use and think about in our personal lives when we feel inflation. This persistently sticky core inflation, though, the number that you see on as a dotted line, on the right-hand side, this is the area that the Federal Reserve has been particularly concerned about. The Federal Reserve looks at the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index as their measure of inflation, and they're looking for that core number, the dotted line on the right-hand side, to come down to 2%. And because they're still at nearly 4.5%, they're looking at these numbers being nearly twice or actually more than twice the number that they're targeting. And we're really at that hard part of bringing down inflation to these last few single digits. Now, this is the backdrop on which we are looking at the portfolio. So if we can move forward, please, to the compliance page. One more. Thank you. The portfolio's primary focus is to first and foremost look at safety and liquidity, and then having a return that earns a market rate of return through budgetary cycles. And we here at Chandler check compliance on both a pre-trade basis, which is the requirement of code, and on a post-trade basis, which is a best practice. The portfolio, as you can see on both this page and the next, remains in compliance with both state law and your most recent investment policy. If we can move forward two pages, please, to the portfolio characteristics. Thank you. I'll now walk through how the agency is performing to the mandate of safety, liquidity, and that market return. The next few pages shows a consolidated view of the performance across not only the portfolios managed by Chandler, but also includes the returns from LAIF, your Wells Fargo bank account, and U.S. Bank Corp. You can see in the middle of the page, the line that says average purchase yield, that number has been increasing from 2.65% to 3.64% as we have been reinvesting into a higher interest rate environment and added new money to an enhanced cash portfolio. This enhanced cash portfolio is really helping support the liquidity of the agency, but also is able to take advantage of those higher rates at the short end of the inverted yield curve, as I mentioned earlier. Although I would comment that the market yield has increased from 3.4% to 4.62%, there is an inverted relationship between market yields and market value. So therefore, the one thing that I would say is surprising that you see here is that the total market value has actually increased to $280 million. And this number has gone higher because of higher interest income and higher balances in the Wells Fargo operating account. And all in all, this remains a high quality portfolio, as you can see from the AAAA/Aa1 rating, in that the U.S. government is rated AA plus now by both S&P and Fitch. If we move forward to the next slide, please. This is all a very highly diversified portfolio, which, as you can see, the agency is using all of its options in its toolkit. It is maintaining strong liquidity in a number of ways. I would point to the cash percentage is at 16%. That's about 44 million. You have nearly 50 million in LAIF, and your money market fund is at 1%. And from an overall portfolio perspective, we are managing both the inherited securities that we've received, as well as reinvesting new monies into additional securities that are all under state code and your investment policy. If you move forward to the next slide, please. You will notice from a duration perspective, this is another way to measure the overall liquidity in the portfolio. Within the next few months, within the next half year, you can see that about 40% is either in cash or will be maturing. And within the year, about 50% of the portfolio is liquid. I will also comment that if you look at this overall picture, you may notice that there's less maturities in the 3-year and 4-year range. And this was intentional because as we began initially investing, we inherited, as I said, a number of different securities, but we wanted to make sure that we brought the portfolio to target. So we had a bit of a barbell strategy, meaning we bought securities that were on the short end that helped support that liquidity piece, as well as the higher interest rates at the short end, but also bought purchase securities that were a bit longer to help bring the account to target. This is a benefit to the portfolio because although we have an inverted yield curve, the yield curve is also looking at yields that are higher than what the expectation is for the longer term, thereby locking in higher rates for the portfolio. So with that said, I will stop and for any questions, thank you.
Thank you. Anything more, Rochelle, on the presentation? No, thank you. Are there any public comments? Cards first?
No public comment at this time.
All right, thank you. Questions from the board members? Committee member? Vice President Goosey, go ahead.
I just want to say I really appreciate the summary. Could not read any of the slides. So if you could make them larger and maybe highlight the important pieces, because the detail that you covered, we couldn't read it. And I'm sure the public would like to see it too. I do think the highlights that you hit were really interesting, and we should make sure everybody can catch that. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, thank you. We move on to the next item. I think is item number 5, yes. Item number 5 is the review financing plan scenarios. And Ms. Patterson, please.
So I just have a brief introduction. So in February of 2023, the board approved a financing plan to fund the operations of the agency, as well as a 10-year CIP forecast through a combination of water revenues, a bond, grants, and direct staff to submit an application for the federal loan program with WIFIA. That financing plan, which we've identified as 3A, had $747 million of capital projects through fiscal year 2032. Since February, nearly $400 million of CIP projects have been added to the 10-year forecast due to regulatory changes from the PFAS MCL being reduced, additional wells, treatment facilities needed to be added. Those facilities accounted for about 38% of the increase, or about $143.7 million. Regional emergency storage accounted for 22%, and pipeline replacements or relocations accounted for about 8%. Of the increase, 34 new projects were added that totaled about $242 million. The balance of the projects were increased due to either receiving current cost estimates, some driven by inflation, environmental, or regulatory requirements of WIFIA. The financing plan that was approved in February also recognized the need to complete a cost of service study and rate study to be effective 1 year earlier than planned. That would have been July of 2025. With the addition of approximately $400 million in projects over the next 10-year forecast, new financing scenarios were created to show what we need to do in order to maintain current and future operations while funding the $1.1 billion in CIP projects. So Laura Nichols from Fieldman Rollup is going to run you through a short presentation on the new financing scenarios prior to the discussion.
Thank you very much, Rochelle. I appreciate the introductions. As Rochelle indicated, today's meeting is to discuss not only the implementation changes regarding the capital improvement program that was reviewed and approved by the board in February, but also to review what those changes have implemented in connection with the long-range financial plan costs, both on the revenue side and the operation maintenance side. In slides to come, I'll be reviewing the cost differences that Rochelle just provide an overview of. And then after those CIP slides, we'll be discussing the actual long-range financial plan forecast in general and how the initial scenario 3A has been modified to include those additional $400 million in capital project costs. We will then be presenting scenarios 3B and 3C for the committee's review going forward. I'll go through these slides and then provide an opportunity for the committee to ask any questions. We do have the engineering staff, finance team, and the consultants here on the line to go over any future questions. Next slide, please. What we want to review first is the timeline of progress made and tasks completed with the finance team and the district agency staff. In February 2023, as we mentioned, we reviewed with the finance committee and the board the proposed forecast of rates and financial pro forma that was based off of the fiscal year 2023 budget assumptions. Since those assumptions were reviewed and completed, the next month, the immediate next month in March, at approximately March 14th, EPA announced new PFAS regulations. These regulations implemented new maximum level contaminants for different PFOA and PFAS chemicals currently located in the agency's wells. They indicated that should these regulations be approved by the end of the calendar year, any agency impacted by these chemicals would require a three-year implementation process, a three-year plan to treat these chemicals in the water. Following these implementation strategies, agency's engineering team reviewed and revised the capital improvement program to include these additional PFAS regulatory projects, in addition to other projects that the implementation stages of a master plan we're looking into. And with those new CIP projects, we took another hard look at the forecasting results and made necessary changes to some of the operating costs that will be a direct result of implementing some of those capital projects. Very recently, just last month, board approved, and just this month we closed the 2023 bond issuance that allowed the agency to issue approximately $75 million in proceeds for some of those high priority projects. Currently, between this calendar year and next calendar year, we are working on implementing those additional assumptions in any capital improvement program prioritization the board would like to see, and finalizing a plan for the application to be submitted to EPA by the end of the year, which allows us to formulate and finalize a WIFIA loan agreement with the EPA. Next slide, please. To go into a little bit of an overview of some of the changes in the CIP itself and how that resulted in changes to the O&M. As I noted, the PFAS-related projects implemented a higher cost and new projects for additional well treatments that summed to approximately $160 million for some of those projects. Those project costs, again, were in addition to what the committee and board had reviewed in February of this year. Because of those new additional PFAS projects, we updated the operation and maintenance costs with staff's assistance to reflect about $6.1 million of additional operation and maintenance costs pertaining to those PFAS treatment plants. And that 6.1 is a gradual increase over the next five-year period. Now, with these higher capital costs and these additional O&M costs, the original proposed scenario 3A did not produce or did not generate enough revenue to continue meeting those ongoing capital costs and O&M costs. Thus, in our slides to come, we'll be reviewing the differences between scenario 3A and some proposed financial structures that can be implemented to meet some of those higher costs. One of the scenarios, which we're classifying as scenario 3C, is a strategy to incur or to go out to additional rate adjustments 1 year prior to what scenario 3A had originally assumed. That would be adjusting rates starting July 1st, 2024. And we'll be discussing that again in further slides. But first, here on the next slide, what we wanted to review with the committee is the overview of the capital program. Again, as Rochelle indicated, split up between the $1.1 billion of total capital improvement projects. Highest component you see here in blue, and approximately 32%, is related to water system improvements and replacements. Those will include pipes, tanks, pumps, wells, items like that that the agency will need to improve and update over a 10-year period. The next highest portion of the capital improvement program is related to water quality, which included the PFAS regulatory changes, in addition to other well-related contaminants such as perchlorates, VOC, and again, additional water treatment. The next highest portion of capital projects and categories is emergency storage at approximately $200 million, and then the additional project costs $100 million for anything related to water supply reliability, such as storage and water banking and recycled water programs. What we want to go over here on the next slide, slide five, is now that we understand the categories or the total costs for our revised July portion of the 10-year CIP, how does that compare to those same categories when we reviewed it back in February 2023? The highest component, again, approximately 30% related to the water system improvements, that had increased about 75%. Or 25% since last February's $290 million, that is now $360 million. The next line down related to water quality, currently estimated to be $299 million, that has increased in project size as well as costs by 150% of the original proposed category of projects. The next highest component is the emergency storage, which again has increased approximately 75% since its initial proposed cost of $115 million. All these categories, again, sum to a revised total proposed cost of $1.1 billion. And we wanted to go over in a little bit of an overview detail is the chart below is how we are proposing to fund the revised 10-year CIP. In February, we had similar funding sources where we were reviewing and analyzing the benefits of the WIFIA loan program. So the initial $747 million was going to be funded by a combination of a WIFIA loan through the EPA, additional PAYGO-related project costs, so reserves and incoming current revenues, in addition to future bonds. What you'll see now is we've expanded those categories further during this current CIP review. That will include, again, the WIFIA loan program. We're able to optimize more funding towards that WIFIA loan program. Again, if you recall, WIFIA can fund up to 49% of total capital projects. Since we've included more eligible projects in that WIFIA loan agreement, we've been able to optimize or increase the load that can be funded from those WIFIA loans. In addition, we've had to include additional bond issuances, again, from the 2023 executed bond series, and then potential future debt issued over the 10-year period. We were able to increase the amount of grants allocated to those project costs. Previously, it was approximately $8 million. Now we've optimized that grants based off communication from staff. That is now approximately $38 million of those projects can be funded with incoming grant receipts. And lastly, we are still able to fund the agency's estimated PAYGO plans with the generated revenue from every scenario 3A, 3B, and 3C. Can fund approximately $35 million in PAYGO-related projects. And lastly, we have included an assumption of a State Water Resources Control Board, which is a very attractive rate, 0% for this loan for some of their related project capital costs. To go into a little more detail of those funding sources and to compare those annual project costs with the prior CIP reviewed in February, let's proceed to slide six. What slide six represents is each bar chart represents each annual's expenditure of capital costs for the proposed $1.1 billion and its related funding source. So again, as we see highlighted in blue, over $35 million and approximately $35 million is being allocated towards PAYGO, utilizing the agency's current reserves and incoming revenues to meet some of those additional projects. Again, in orange, or light green, salmon color, we've included the WIFIA related funding for those capital projects. A large portion of those capital projects we've allocated towards those years, fiscal year 25 through 27. Again, those are some of the highest incurred costs for capital in total, ranging from $160 to $180 million in annual capital needs for this revised CIP plan. And again, you'll see the additional projects, including grants, as well future debt that can fund the remaining costs. In comparison, you'll see how the annual cost has moved or adjusted since the February $747 million total CIP. Next slide, please. What we've analyzed here, and apologies for the small format, I will explain each one of these line items, but it takes into our reviews, it takes into account the scenario 3A we initially reviewed with the committee and board and compares it to our two revised finance plan scenarios. And again, the revised scenarios is to implement the new CIP, summing to $1.1 billion, where we're able to modify the funding sources, optimize the low-cost governmental loan programs, which does include the state revolving fund loan, in addition to adjusting the rate revenues to continue to meet the $35 million in PAYGO-related projects expenditures. Each line, starting from the top, first identifies the proposed rate adjustments. Again, 6.5% was approved by the board a few years ago for the five-year CIP. That five-year CIP goes through fiscal year 2027 at 6.5%. So the initial plan was to adjust rates in 26 to approximately 9% and 8% thereafter. Again, slightly higher than the previously approved 6.5%. That was in order to fund these proposed future debt, as well as meet additional reserve target levels and meet adequate debt service coverage results. What we're showing on the bottom two lines or bottom three lines of these individual scenarios is one, the projected debt service costs. Scenario 3A proposed annual debt service costs ranging from $33 million to $42 million. And the monthly average impact is based off of the average residential payer, assuming 18 CCFs in usage. This does not include or this excludes any legacy debt charge in these numbers shown on the screen. To compare scenario 3A to 3B, 3B assumes the same adjustment in rates starting in fiscal year 2026. Instead of 9%, however, the new rates for this finance plan with the higher capital costs and the higher O&M costs would require 12% in additional rate revenue. Then 12% will be consistent through fiscal year 2028 before it starts dropping down again to that 5% level. As I noted, since that additional $400 million project has been added, approximately $300 million of that is allocated towards debt funding. Again, $300 million to WIFIA loan funding and approximately $100 million of that towards additional bonds and the $75 million already funded in the 2023 bond issuance. What that results in is proposed additional debt service costs ranging again from $33 million in 2023 to approximately $44 million at the end of 2032. This does use a bit more of the agency's reserves. With the higher additional project costs and higher O&M, we do have lower anticipated reserve funding, trying to optimize the level of PAYGO needs that the agency has to generate towards this project while still maintaining the credit pro forma of the agency. To give a little bit of additional financial scenarios, scenario 3C reflects an adjustment in the timing of the new rates. Instead of starting in fiscal year 2026, which as you see was a 12% increase that reflected monthly impacts ranging from $4 to $8, $8.60 in 2028, we have prepared an additional scenario that pushes and smooths out the rates to 1 year prior. Starting in fiscal year 2025, the proposition is a 10.5% rate increase instead of the previously approved 6.5%. That increases the monthly impact by $2.50, again, compared to scenario 3A. That 10% then goes through 2027, allowing us to reduce that rate charge to ratepayers by 9%, 8% to down to 5% over that 10-year window. What I wanted to iterate and make clear to the committee is both scenarios 3B and 3C assume the same CIP issuances, same CIP debt costs, as well as the same amount of PAYGO. So you'll see comparing the two, debt service issued by the agency will be identical. The only thing we're changing is the strategy of implementing those rate revenues to meet some of those ongoing expenditures and ongoing CIP needs. I think what is important to review can be shown on the next slide, which directly compares the differences between each scenario for rate increase comparison purposes. In blue, we've identified the original February 2023 version, which has 6.5% in 25, jumps to 9%, 8%, and 7% thereafter. Immediately to the right of the blue is the orange bars, which represents scenario 3B. Again, same timing for rate adjustments, but it does reflect a higher proposed rates in order to meet a higher proposed CIP plan and operation and maintenance costs of the agency. So that jumps at 6.5 previously assumed up to 12% as opposed to a 9% in 2026, and then drops back down to 9% in 2029. If that scenario provides too high of adjustment in 2026, the green version is what we're classifying as scenario 3C, where just rates starting in 2025, again, 1 year earlier than the originally proposed scenario 3A, where that rate becomes a 10.5% rate increase in 25, 10% in 26, 27, and then drops down to 9% in 28, 29. All of these are proposed rate adjustments. Any one of these scenarios needs to be approved officially by the board and through a regularly public hearing. Anything discussed today and any new scenario we are provide does not commit the board or the committee to any one of these rates. These are strategies and financial plans that can be implemented to meet some of these ongoing costs. And as we are proposed new scenarios, we're happy to make further adjustments to some of these financial structures and revenue generated revenue ideas. Next slide, please. This last slide here of our financial deck is four scenarios, 3B and 3C. We wanted to show the agency some of the proposed debt service costs that could be implemented by the agency to meet the revised CIP. We have included the existing debt costs of the agency, which is the 1999 bonds, 2018, 2020 bonds, Series A and B, and the recently executed 2023 bonds. On top of those bond issuances, we've included the proposed financing of this additional CIP plan for two additional bond issuances, as well as the two additional WIFIA loans. And as you recall from prior discussions, one of the benefits of the WIFIA program is the ability to push back those debt service payments to the years that can afford additional costs and still stretch that cost over long term. Again, benefiting on a long-term basis ratepayers of the agency over that 35-year repayment period. We're able to levelize that cost of debt service starting in fiscal year 2039 using the financial benefits of the terms on the EPA's WIFIA loan structure. Again, the WIFIA loans work such that if the agency were to not complete or not go forward with any of the projects that are currently proposed, WIFIA loan itself will be based off the actual draws of the WIFIA loan, and the cost or the interest rates will be fixed once that loan is closed. That estimate of the loans we provided in the finance plan is currently 4.5% for the first WIFIA loan and approximately 5% for the second WIFIA loan. Again, none of those costs have yet been executed or fixed. They're still subject to change going forward. But with this revised finance plan, with the revenue generated, we do believe this is an appropriate credit strategy to also maintain the agency's ratings as you look to fund your CIP with future debt going forward. Next slide. I believe this concludes our financial related presentation. I know we've reviewed a lot and discussed a lot. And I believe there are a few questions regarding the CIP itself, regarding those changes and the increase of $400 million. So I'll pause here and open up the floor to the committee, or if Rochelle has anything to add.
No, I just wanted to say the three scenarios are an attachment in your packet, so you can see them closer up, as well as the capital list as attachment too.
Thank you. Any public comment, Erica?
No comment at this time.
Thank you. We'll open it up for questions from the committee. Director Colley, I think you have.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say here. Obviously, the numbers are simply shocking. To propose $104 million as the small little tiny future bond issue on top of $500 million in WIFIA loans, and it's just at some point, and I've said this before, we need to save money at some point. And while I don't doubt that the costs increase due to contamination that we didn't anticipate, our overall plan needs to be better thought out, and we need to save money. We need to not rely on debt and push this problem down the road continuously. Yeah, my comments have been the same for 20 years. So it's kind of, how we arrived here today. I also noted on slide 9 that, we have this wonderful plateau where we have this debt, but out to what, 2067 or something more than, way out in the future. I can't imagine that we're not going to have some other need for some other future debts when we don't have the ability to spend our money on something other than interest payments. So we really need to think this through a whole lot more.
Vice President Gusite.
It is always fun when I agree with Director Colley. I'm teasing. I greatly prefer sticking with 3A for a couple. I mean, the optics look bad. I will say that the interest rate is attractive on these loans, but that doesn't mean we need to add more just because it's a good interest rate. It's like buying more house than you need, and people do it, but I wouldn't do it. The PFAS change, the regulatory change on the PFAS was $143 million, but we are presented with $400 million total ask. So that means $257 million was not related to regulatory changes beyond our control. Everybody can read the thing, but I mean, for instance, the Earl Schmidt filtration tank was presented at $50,000, and then now in 3 months, 4 months maybe, the cost is went from $50,000 to $8 million in 3 months. It just looks bad. I'm sure there may very well be a good reason for that, but we report to the public, and this is just looks bad. It leaves us with an additional debt at the end of the period, assuming no other borrowing other than this, we would be $275 million in additional debt at the end of 10 years. But yeah, if there was more borrowing than what we're presented with, that debt could even be higher. And lastly, I think the most compelling to me is that I want to see a demonstration of savings. I want to see us look at every project, and some do, but cost estimates, figure out what is this costing us per hour. The item that was delayed or moved back at the next agenda item we're going to talk about, $42,000 for a study, assuming a very extremely generous above engineering rate of $300 an hour in cost, that's 140 hours of work for an affordability study that our staff already did a back of napkin calculation. And yes, that's not a lot of money, but we say yes to everything all the time. We don't get competitive bids for some of these things because it's some consultant that somebody knows. And I'm tired of it. I'm sorry. I mean, I appreciate a lot of our stuff is great. We are a technologically wonderful agency. We are facing a lot of challenges and responding, but we need to say no to stuff. This is, to me, like any business. I work in the private sector. If costs go up, something else gets cut, and that's the way it is. And I think we need to look at that because this is disturbing.
Director Amichaj.
Thank you. First of all, thank you, Ms. Patterson and Ms. Nichols, for your presentation. I always appreciate your presentation style, Ms. Nichols. So thank you for the way you present. I am in agreement with the rest of you as well, or two of you. We haven't heard from Chair Peterson yet. When I read this agenda item, I just thought, oh my gosh, we just went through this long, tedious process already. And lengthy process to kind of explore these options and decide finally on most of us on 3A and got board approval for it. And now we're being asked to kind of go through this again, but with a significant increase in costs, and even more debt and even more increases in rates. So I did appreciate the conversation that I had with Ms. Patterson. She explained to me the reason behind a lot of the increase in the costs that are tied to the requirements in order to use the WIFIA loan funding. So I appreciated that explanation. It helped me understand some of that better. But I feel like it was already such a big pill to swallow to approve 3A with the rate increases upped in time and in amount already. And I agree, I think we should just stick with 3A as well. And I realize it's going to force choices to be made. And I just want to say that I hope that the PFAS treatment plants projects are the ones that get prioritized to make sure that we're serving safe water for our public. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you. to me, too, also is pretty... I kind of agree with all three of you about the whole thing, but we're being kind of pushed into a kind of a cul-de-sac with the WIFIA loans, as has already been mentioned a little bit here, and usually in these kind of projects that we have capital projects, and you can see it from the financials that we have at the year end, it is very hard for us or any agency really to spend money on capital and to do it right and to do it. And I've, in my experience and all the years I've worked on these kind of things, it's the same thing. You get to a level, you can get the project out and it's done. But there's always delays. The thing about the WIFIA loans is that it gives us, opportunity for cheaper money, but it has so much requirements put on it that for one requirement is this 10-year idea that we have to have the project done in 10 years, or is it after 10 years?
Laura would know more, but the 10 years is a 10-year master agreement. It's for the 10 years of projects that have been identified. Courtney, do you know? Laura, it's 4 or 5 years.
Correct. The actual construction schedule for the agency can span depending on its individual project needs. EPA usually is very comfortable with a 4 to 5. They've even approved a 7-year construction window. There's no 10-year requirement under the EPA program. The only requirement EPA has under their master program is the agency must execute all its WIFIA loans within a 5-year period. And we've selected programs or projects that last a 10-year window.
So basically,
does that answer your question, Director?
I'm not sure. let me try to rephrase it a little bit. So when the loan is enacted for the project and the project is approved, that project has to have that money sitting there ready to be expended in that 7-year period or 5-year period?
Once the WIFIA loan agreement is executed with the EPA, you will indicate to the EPA the construction schedule for all of those projects to complete it in that timely manner. And you may draw from EPA for the full amount of that project needs up to 49%. Future loan agreements can have different loan requirements. The only statute is that you should execute loan agreements within a 5-year window of the master agreement approval. But each individual project schedule director can have its own individual construction needs.
I understand now. So, my thought in thinking about this past weekend, after I read the packets, is that it'd be nicer to spread out some of these projects further out to deal with and not try to compress everything in one 10-year period. But absence of any further discussion about this, my feeling is to stay with the 3A scenario for now, and we'll just, as they say, kick the can down the road a little bit and see what happens. Okay, anything, any more comments? No, go ahead.
So, yeah, an interesting history note, I think in 2008, the world went to hell. At least the financial world went to hell. And this agency, when I say this agency, what I mean is the historic CLWA, of course, and because I was on the board there. So CLWA in 2008 basically shut down its CIP program. Or curtailed it a lot. We continue to pretty much meet the needs of the valley. We delivered water. It was safe and it was a reasonable cost. I think we need to, in this climate particularly, think more in terms of how we thought in 2008. This interest rate environment is higher than it's been in many, many, many years. And our debt service is higher than it's been. And we really need to, like I said before, think more in terms of cutting costs. And I think what I kind of heard from the other members of the committee is that we would prefer, I think, that staff look to see how you can make do on what was previously planned, even if that means that we don't do as much. And so my point on the 2008 thing is that we've done that in the past and we lived through it. So, I think that's, at least this committee's thought is that that's kind of the way staff ought to look at it. I note that one of the things that I've mentioned in the past is that we have this strange structure that we use. We have an engineering committee that presumably says build and do things, and they hand the bill to this committee and say pay it. That's kind of maybe overly simplistic and maybe even inflammatory, but it kind of feels that way. I think it's unfortunate that we've sort of structured ourselves that way. But I think what you're hearing a little bit from this committee is that we've kind of had enough of just paying the bill, no matter what it is. Thanks.
And Director Colley, I am on the engineering committee also.
Yeah.
I'm the enemy too. Without any further comments, thank you.
I appreciate it. Actually, we wanted to provoke a reaction so we knew what the committee's opinion was. You know, I think going through this, there's a number of contributing factors to the increase, and you know, Rochelle and Courtney and Steve and Mike and I were working through the last couple of weeks to try to get that breakdown to understand what the moving parts were in those estimates. Because it is, it was like, wow, how did that happen? What's the change? And there are things that shifted into the 10-year window. There are insights from projects, you know, one of the filter replacement, you know, effort at the plant, realized probably need to accelerate some of those things that had been put off in 2008 and are now coming due. You know, so it's a mix of things. And I think our intent was, this is the start of the conversation to try to understand what's the pain threshold fiscally, and also then go back and say, okay, what's the prioritization in the CIP? So, you know, I can't guarantee we can get to a 3A and still be comfortably meeting our obligations, but we can certainly show you options and priorities for what that looks like. And there are some projects that there will be some calculated risks. For example, emergency storage is one of the big dollar drivers. The other is condition of facilities. About a third of the overall CIP is just keeping up with pipes, pumps, reservoirs, and, you know, the question is there any, you know, is there slack there? And I think that's also, we have a couple of big investments that aren't reflected in there yet. Sorry to say, there's not money in there for AVEC storage. There's not much money in there for sites, partly because there's a possibility that might be able to be paid for through the statement of charges on the state water project and therefore covered under the, you know, the tax funding source. But that's an unanswered question still. So hear you loud and clear. We will try to go back and see what we can prioritize with the idea of still providing the level of service that we need to provide. And it may be a little bit of a back and forth here, but that's why we also wanted to start this process soon, because we know if we're going to do anything early, we need to know what that is so we can do that whole 218 process. And if we're not, then that gives us a little more time, but just appreciate the input on this.
Thank you. Okay, we just talked about item 5. Now we can go to 4. Item 4, discuss water affordability study. Rochelle?
So at last year's Aqua Conference, there was a session topic on water affordability. As utility affordability has been a talking point this year, staff felt it was an opportunity to bring this topic to the committee to determine if this type of analysis would be beneficial to the agency. The discussion and presentation on a water affordability study or water affordability analysis will talk through the process and methodologies if the committee chooses to move forward with performing the analysis. If so, what methodologies should be used, and if the analysis should be performed by staff or by a consultant. Some benefits of this type of analysis can enable the board to make informed choices when designing rate structures that balance revenue needs with affordability concerns. The study's findings can inform the design of targeted assistance program for low-income households, such as the ratepayer assistance program, to ensure that these households can afford their water bills while maintaining the financial position of the agency. The committee may also direct staff to use alternative metrics or indicators to assess affordability without conducting a formal study. These could include comparing water bills to median household income, comparing water bills to nearby agencies, or using other local economic benchmarks. staff reached out to Dr. Lucille Hans from the Alliance for Water Efficiency, as she has worked with other agencies to see what data and methodologies were used in an affordability analysis. A little bit about Lucille. She joined the Alliance for Water Efficiency in April of 2022 as the Director of Programs. She focuses on program leadership and management, knowledge development, and fostering partnerships with collaborations while serving a collective of an amazing water conservation and efficiency organization and professionals. She previously led the water conservation and water resource teams at Fort Collins Utilities in Fort Collins, Colorado. She also worked at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory on energy policy, behavioral research, and the energy-water nexus. She received her PhD in economics from Colorado State University, where she focused on water and energy, utility rates, behavioral economics, and was also a member of the City of Fort Collins Water Board. So at this time, I'd like to have Lucille go through her presentation.
Great, thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yes, we can.
Great, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. I'm glad to be here. Yes, affordability is certainly top of mind across the nation. We have the privilege of working with over, trying to think how many utility members the Alliance for Water Efficiency has, but I think over 400. So it's top of mind across the nation and in Canada as well. And I'm really glad that this is a topic that's relevant in your community and that you're discussing it tonight. So next slide, please. The Alliance for Water Efficiency is really, it's a nonprofit and we're a stakeholder base. So we have over 500 members across the US and Canada, and we're committed to the sustainable and efficient use of water, which is of course directly connected to affordability discussions. So we focus on these three areas of effort: collaboration, bringing people and practitioners together, knowledge creations, research and analysis like these affordability assessment projects, and developing tools, trainings, and others to help our members, and then advocating for change in smart policies. Next slide, please. SCB has been an active member since 2010, or, you know, the previous versions of the organization, of course, the member agencies that have come together since. Is a key contributor for our cooling technology study, which has developed really great resources and tools to help folks addressing the increasing cooling demands, which of course increase water demands. And then Matt Dickens is our awesome co-chair of our research committee. Next slide, please. So here's a few of our other affordability assessments that we've done, although each of these have been very different potentially depending on the needs and the data of the community. And so the Alliance for Water Efficiency, while we're not rate consultants or folks that just churn out rate studies, we do have a rich history in working in the rate space because we know that affordability, conservation, efficiency, and also meeting revenue needs are very connected. And so in addition to these assessments that we do, we maintain a website called Financing Sustainable Water with resources and models to help balance revenues and resource efficiency. And we've completed rates workshops with several communities across the United States to tackle the very real challenges that you all are facing that are very consistent across the challenges that others are facing. And so while we don't do rate studies, but historically rate studies haven't always looked at affordability. And so this type of work is a really great complement or effort that can meet multiple needs across an organization. Next slide, please. So a bit more about why focusing on water affordability. It's an essential service and it must be available for a home to be inhabitable. And hopefully rate increases shouldn't impact people's access to affordable water service or impact their ability to be in a safe and healthy home. And affordability is a complicated term that can be described in lots of different ways. Oftentimes, affordability might mean looking at water that is reasonably priced, sort of relative to its valuable, but also accessibly priced. So being able to access it relative to your income. Ideally, affordable water service can also be viewed as the ability for a customer to pay the bill in full and on time without jeopardizing that customer's ability to also pay for other essential expenses. So the water bill is only one part of a household's basic living expenses. We can go to the next slide, that's fine, perfect. So this proposed assessment could include the following components, including a review about other agencies, especially in California, are addressing affordability challenges. We would document all that SCB is currently doing or planning to do related to affordability, conduct then an in-depth data analysis and assessment of affordability and future affordability under future rate increases or potential scenarios of increases, like the ones that you all are just discussing, which can be done using one or a combination of metrics. And we can bring in additional analysis and data to richen the understanding of your community and better understand who is being challenged and what areas of your community you might want to focus on. And I'll just remind that we're focused on household level affordability rather than looking at sort of community or utility level affordability. And the focus is on residential, as that's the majority of the connections in the service area. So I appreciate being able to be here to have this upfront conversation and get your feedback on this approach. Next slide, please. So a little bit about the history of working in this space. You know, with growing income disparities and very disparate community-specific cost of living, no one metric can really serve as necessarily the one right metric for understanding when water service is affordable for individual households. So the EPA originally created affordability screening analysis and standards back in the 90s to understand the impact of complying with water quality standards under the Clean Water Act. And this guidance primarily looked at what was called the residential indicator, which is basically the metric that's here on this slide here, which is the average cost of bills relative to a median household income in the service area. And 2% or more was deemed to be a signal of a large economic impact on residents, meaning that the community is likely to experience economic hardship in complying with the water quality standards. Later, EPA talked about how they would consider drinking water regulation to be unaffordable in small communities if the standard would result in a water bill in excess of 2.5% of a national median household income across small communities. And so over time, it has commonly been inferred from these original development of metrics that 2.5% and 2% for 2.5 for water and 2% for water, so combined 4.5 for both, is sort of the standard for determining affordability. However, unfortunately, these things have been conflated over time. So what was originally developed for a purpose around like the Clean Water Act has been conflated with this idea of householder affordability. But there are various challenges which I've listed here. The big one that has been criticized, especially in recent years, is that median household income is not well correlated with poverty and really doesn't capture the challenges where you have diverse populations and wide spreads of income. And we know that the income distribution tends to be widening rather than closing. And so when we're looking at the impacts to a median household, you're not really capturing the impacts on the low-income households, which are the folks who are most sensitive to water rate changes. Next slide, please. So here's some examples of improved approaches that are being explored and utilized in improved affordability assessments of household affordability. The top one is commonly known as the household burden indicator, which instead of looking at that water bill as a function of median household income, it's looking at the 20th percentile of income. So the lowest 20% of earners in your community, looking at how those households are impacted, not the median and not the average households, but looking at those low-income households. You can also look at a metric, that middle one is looking more at looking at the income that's left over after you've already paid for other essential household expenses, so your energy bills and other things, you know, food, things like that, that you need to survive as well. And sometimes folks look at average versus basic residential water use, although oftentimes lower income households are only using basic services or water service. They're not typically using a lot of water outdoors or in other discretionary ways. The final one there is looking at how many hours you would have to work at minimum hourly wage in a community to be able to afford a water bill. So that's a common one that's used to be able to put it in a commonly understood term, because it's pretty easy to think about how many hours you'd have to work at minimum wage. Next slide, please. So the proposed assessment approach is the one that's included here, although certainly open for input and discussion if this overall study is of interest to the community. This one would be looking at the household burden indicator, which is looking at that 20th percentile of income, those households, which was the first one on the previous slide. And then bringing in some additional richness. Oftentimes we bring in poverty prevalence indicator, which combines then some information about the prevalence of households that are at or below a certain poverty threshold as indicated here. And then we typically bring in, combine these different metrics together to create some qualitative categorization that makes it easier to talk about what you're seeing. So the assessment is, you can do this in a really simple, straightforward way where you come up with one number for your entire community. But what we do is we dig into the census level data at the census tract level. We bring in monthly utility bills. And this creates a more individualized analysis and brings in that richness of better being able to understand where in your community folks are struggling, how much are they struggling, how big is the challenge, how big might the challenge be in the future. And we can look at it in multiple ways and bring in additional data about where there are likely to be more renters or where there's likely to be more elderly folks based on census data. And then bring in your own data based on where you're seeing folks that are having challenges with paying or complying with payment plans or challenges with historically being shut off over time. And then ultimately, this can really help you target your outreach for your programs and resources and increase communications with the communities and the households who need it the most. Next slide, please. Here's a, I'm going to give you a few nuggets from our most recent one, which was with the City of Houston. And this shows all the census tracts that are in the Houston Public Works Service area. And this shows the average water and sewer bills. They provide both water and sewer by census tract, and ones for 2021. And then ones looking forward ahead at 2025, their projected rates. And you can see water bills are projected to increase quite significantly in their community from where they're currently at. But then if you bring in the combination of not only their water and sewer bill with their household income, the 20th percentile of income, then you go to the next slide. And this shows the household burden indicator. So where it's dark here is showing households that are paying the higher proportion of their income to water and sewer bills. And it's not necessarily correlated with where you have high water use. And in fact, it's typically in Houston correlated where there's actually fairly low water use. It's just that incomes are so low in some of these areas of the community. So this is the type of richness that you can look at in some of these analyses, and we can customize it as what makes sense and what's valuable. Next slide. This is the qualitative piece that I mentioned where we're combining both that household burden indicator as well as the poverty prevalence indicator, being able to assess how many tracts are within each of these categories so you can better understand at a qualitative scale that might be more accessible to the public what you're focused on here. So for here, an example in the City of Houston, they're expecting a big increase in the high and very high burden households from 2019 projected into 2025. Next slide, please. So a quick back of the envelope calculations. This is looking at a variety of situations where we're looking at either median income, a 20th percentile of income, or an example of a very low income tract, what the income level is there from the census data. And then looking at residential water use, which is an average of 18 units, or if we're looking at maybe what's really basic considered as maybe 4 units, and then you can see the next column shows their annual water costs and then the calculated household burden indicator, just to give you a sense. And so, for example, that median one shows that when we're just looking at median income, folks earning at that level, if they're using that level of water, are spending less than 1% of their annual income on their water bill. Whereas if you look at those in the 20th percentile of income, it's a different story. We're over 1%. And if we're looking at average water usage, you know, we're over 2.5%, which we remember the EPA number was 2.5%. And then if you look at those very low income tracts, it's even higher than that. And this is using current water costs. So this isn't incorporating what those projected rate increases will look like. Next slide, please. So here's another example of some back of the envelope calculations. This is the one using the minimum hourly wage in a community. So what the first one looks at is based on the average household water bill. And that's looking at approximately 50 hours per year, about 4 hours per month to be able to pay for the average residential water use of 18 units. And then the second one is looking at that basic level of 4 units. Next slide, please. So part of the study and project would be to connect analysis that helps inform the metrics and benchmarks that your organization wants to use for assessing affordability now and into the future. This graphic is from Houston, which is one example of what could become a metric. So potentially targeting a number of households or census tracts that are at or below a certain household burden indicator, for example. But you can bring in some additional metrics about how many customers are currently in debt or on payment plans, enrolled in your programs, currently have their water shut off, things like that. So there's lots of ways to build this. This process can help create a data-informed way to determine what targets you want to use as one of your metrics that your organization works toward. Next slide. This was a timeline that was sort of based on maybe the most expedited version of doing this study to be able to inform the work that you all are doing with your rates. It can certainly change depending on, of course, the scenarios that you ultimately go with and the timelines for your rate study. So I think that's my last slide. So happy to be here and happy to be part of the conversation and answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Rochelle, you want to add anything?
No.
All right, we have Erica. Do we have
yes, any? We do have public comment today. Yeah. First up is Sandra Cattell. I hope I said that right. Okay, you may approach the podium. You have 3 minutes for your public comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I start, I want to thank Liesl Hans for having such a nice presentation that people can read in the agenda and also see it on the board. That's very important when you're asking for public comment, that the people who are in the public can actually see what they're going to be commenting on. So thank you very much. As was mentioned, you know, water is a very important human need, and everybody should have access to good, clean water. It's not for me to decide. Obviously, it's for you to decide if you're going to have an in-agency or out-of-agency evaluation of this feasibility study. All I can say is I'm very glad that you have a ratepayer assistance program. I think that there should be some consideration for people who are very, very low income, who are trying to pay their water bill and just can't quite make it, who are not necessarily on an ongoing basis going to be eligible for ratepayer assistance. With that said, I'd like to once again, as I have many, many times mentioned, that the electric company still is able to have tiered rates. At one point, we had tiered rates out here. I'm sure there must be some way that we could do that again. It burns me when, you know, people in their 800 square foot house have taken out their lawns and planted a few, very few plants. And people with 2 acres have an acre of lawn and plantings that they water lavishly, and they pay the same rates, and that bothers me a lot. And there should be some way that people who use excessive amounts of water pay more for the water. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Any further public comments?
We do not have any in-person comments, but we do have some that we received online.
Yes, I have those in front of us. Let me read them. The first one, public comment. I'll give them to you guys when I'm finished. The first one is from a Sarah Darden, and she sent this email to Erica at 3:10 p.m. this afternoon. Hello, Ms. Dill. I am a Santa Clarita resident living in Newhall, ahead of tonight's SCV Water Finance and Administration Committee meeting. Please accept this message as my statement of support for the Water Affordability Study, agenda item number 4, and to continue to have a rate.
We're done.
Let me start the sentence again. Please accept this message as my statement of support for the water affordability study, agenda item number 4, and to continue to have a ratepayer's advocate beyond 2023, agenda item number 8. Please share my support with the committee and urge them to decide in support of both of these initiatives. Sincerely, Sir Sarah Darden. The second one on this item is from Kat. Actually, it's that was her email address, but it's Kathleen Walker. And hello, I am a Valencia resident and wanted to share my support for the water affordability study and also for having a ratepayer advocate. Thank you, Kathleen Walker. And she provided her zip code 91355. Any further comments?
That's all the public comment I have at this time for this item.
Okay, thank you. Let's, Ms. Amritraj, Kathy? Yeah. Yeah, go for it.
He sees my notes. That's why he didn't even ask.
Yeah, I knew it.
So first of all, thank you to Dr. Hans for your presentation. Appreciate that. Thank you to Ms. Cattell for your comments and to Ms. Darden and Ms. Walker for their comments as well on this. I want to start by saying that I respect that the agency staff is proposing to go through this process. I think it's especially important and necessary since, you know, given our previous discussion, that we continue to be presented with scenarios with talking about increased rates on what feels like a regular basis. And I think some assume that the population in the Santa Clarita Valley kind of in totality can absorb continued rate increases. And I think we forget sometimes that some families experience cost increases differently and with greater burden than others. I appreciated the line in the memo that reminds us that we need to ensure equitable access to water resources, as Ms. Cattell pointed out in her comments. And it also pointed out that going through this process is, I'm going to deem, protective of the agency because it ensures that people can pay their water bills if we kind of find that sweet spot, if we ever find that sweet spot, but that people can pay their water bills and we're not adding to the list of uncollected funds. So, and I also appreciated that it mentioned in the memo that having the proposed water affordability study also helped the agency with its excellent credit rating, which is great. So it brings that value too. I appreciate Ms. Patterson mentioning that they're having these discussions at Aqua. So other water agencies throughout the state are having these discussions as well and trying to kind of figure out how their customer base can react to differences in their rates and having that sensitivity to, I guess, the differences in there. So I just feel like, you know, we are being given the ability to better understand the consequences of decisions related to rates. And I think taking the approach of just sticking our heads in the sand and saying we'd rather not know is not helpful to our ratepayers and customers. And it doesn't align with our values of integrity and professionalism. So I see tremendous value in this. I think if we are very careful about the way we are asking about our data points and are very clear in the data points that we're asking about so that it indeed is a usable document when it comes back to us. I think that's a really important path to take. And what I would almost say is I don't feel prepared to give that input tonight on this committee at this meeting. So what I would say is if there is consensus to move forward, that I would appreciate one more opportunity to kind of better understand what our options are and kind of give our vision of what we feel would be a truly informative document. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Director Colley.
So I took some time out and read the Long Beach study. It provided Long Beach a quite a few pages of review of their current rates, which interestingly had some really interesting tiered rates. And I'm in agreement with the idea that tiered rates could very much help those with limited income. But, you know, having Long Beach probably knew what their rates were, so they probably didn't need that part of the study. There were a lot of kind of strange statistical analysis that provided nothing that I could tell. At the end of the study, there was, as I recall, less than a column on near the final page or at the final page of some recommendations, none of which were earth-shattering or particularly useful. The entire study, I looked at it and thought, if I was a board member in Long Beach, what action might the study have driven me to do? What was actionable in the study? And my answer to that question was not a darn thing. Spending over $40,000, the price of a decent car nowadays, a couple of years ago it was a couple of cars, but today that's not the case. While yes, indeed, if we spread this out over all of the different folks that we send a bill to, it would be, I guess, around a nickel per month for a year. So that, I guess, does qualify as nickels and dimes, quite literally. But nickels add up. And this one is an obvious thing not to spend money on, in my view. It just simply doesn't provide anything of value. I'm also want to point out that in our valley, the folks who struggle economically very often do not write a check for a water bill. Now, that's not to say that they don't pay for water or their income is not used to buy some water, but there are many places where folks on limited incomes live, where they're behind a master meter, where they share the water bill with perhaps dozens or more of other people and families and whatnot. This kind of a study would do absolutely nothing, in my view, to help us understand that issue. Unfortunately, the people that are behind a master meter, their incentive to save water all but disappears. Because if I am going to have 98% of my water bill paid by others and only 2% of it is my own, then why do I care? And there are certainly many, many people in our valley that are in that state. And I think that there's probably a few of them that are exactly of that mindset. I don't care. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to turn my, you know, I live in a condo. It's got a master meter. I keep the water on while I brush my teeth. Who cares? It doesn't reduce my water bill to shut that water off hardly at all. Tiny, tiny fractions of pennies. So in my way of thinking, if we actually want to address the issue faced by folks of limited means, those kinds of questions are better addressed. And trying to look at the folks that are typically of better means who do write a check for a water bill is not the best approach. So I would recommend that we not spend $40,000+ on this study.
Vice President Gutzeit.
Thank you. I know it's scary. We did not consult. A couple of thoughts on this. As I said before, and I know, you know, we just said that this agency has to make some hard choices. To me, my personal choice is that we have safe water and available water. Everything else, literally everything else, is negotiable to me, including studies, especially when we have very nice preliminary data that our staff already did, and some good ideas from community members. I will, before I forget, thank Sandra Cattell for bringing up the tiered rates that we did have at Newhall Water. And that is an action that I think maybe we could discuss more to help out lower income people, because that has been shown by the state to be a fair way to allocate costs. The state has failed to say that we can use other methods so that some people pay more for their service and other people pay less. The state requires us to pay for the cost of water. So by using tiered rates, if you use less water, like many of these households do, that is allowed by the state and fair. A lot of the other ways that we could do, you know, the board has done a pilot study. We just did a pilot study that isn't fully subscribed yet, meaning the interest wasn't there. Everything else that we do takes money out of someone's pocket who maybe also can't afford it and maybe makes more income and gives it to somebody else. And that's another thing that just seems less of a priority to me. Same with the cost. Again, you know, broken record alert. I think I am going to start denying approval of anything that we don't cost check. $42,000 at $300 an hour is 140 hours of work. We don't need that cost for this project. Our staff can figure it out. You can hire a data entry person and do it. You can hire an accounting specialist from some temp agency, crunch the numbers. Maybe even if somebody's really smart, I'm looking at some of our staff people probably can run a ChatGPT program to figure this all out and pull the data. It's publicly available data. We also know who pays late, what areas and zip codes they live in, and can help them with payment programs. We already know a lot of this. Actionable data. That is a good point, I think, and I have brought this up separately on other topics. If we're not going to take an action, or it doesn't help us make a decision on an action, why are we doing it? The 2 to 2.5% by EPA is great. I hope that they think about that when they pass regulations. I'm not sure that they do, because we just said we're paying close to $200,000 more because they dropped a limit on us. $200 million more over a 10-year period. But EPA sets a threshold of 2 to 2.5%. And even if that is a good number, we also know in California that affordable housing is supposed to be 30% of our income. If anybody in this room pays less than 30% of their income on housing, you are a very lucky person. Because we don't. So these numbers are for people across the country in an ideal situation, and we are far from ideal situation. We're doing the best we can here. The end goal, what are we going to do with this information? We shouldn't pay for stuff if we don't already know what we're going to do with it. What I do like of these thresholds, if staff wanted to proceed with it, is, you know, the median income comparison is interesting and easy enough to do. 20th percentile, also probably the average person that, you know, would start to feel some pain. When we get into these very low income groups. I agree with Director Colley. You know, they're probably not paying for it anyways off their bill. I'm sure the data will show who's paying for what, water or otherwise. But also remember, we don't control jobs. We don't control how many people aren't working, how many people retired here versus moved out of the area. Some of that information, I don't know what we're going to do with it. You know, if they start to have trouble paying their bill, we need to find ways to help them. We need to direct them to resources. We need to consider tiered rates. But some of the data is very interesting, but in a time of challenges, I don't want to pay for interesting data. So
thank you, Vice President Broussard. I just have one question, Ms. Patterson. How are we doing on our geospatial data? Are we pretty much up to date now as far as bringing all the customers into the GIS database that we have?
For like a water budget?
And water budgets?
I believe it's all complete.
All complete now. Okay. So that's part of the data that's being generated presently within our own area of interest. And as far as the census data is concerned, is always available offline, online. I agree with both of you over there. And I agree with Kathy too. If there is something that we can put to see what will give us to make a decision on, basically, that's what this information is necessary for as a board of director. With that, I think we have a consensus that we are not in favor of the contract. Hearing no other objections to that? Other than yours. The majority of the committee, yes. All right.
I do support the staff looking at it when they can, or finding a reasonably priced way of looking at data that we need.
Okay, let's move on.
Yeah, we'll take a look. There is we are a little stretched. That's part of the reason we wanted to put it outside. So please don't expect the deliverables that were talked about here tonight. You have not authorized it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, item six, the actual item six. Recommend approval of revised position control. Rochelle, please.
So this is a recommendation to take advantage of a vacancy in the lead water systems tech position and a retirement from a lead utility operations technician in the treatment, distribution, operations, and maintenance section, known as TDOMS. By restructuring various departments within the section, staff recommends repurposing the two vacant lead positions to two supervisor positions to reduce the span of control over direct reports as recommended by the American Water Works Association. The AWWA recommends a span of control of between 7 and 10. As seen in the committee report, the current supervisors have 14 to 17 direct reports. By repurposing the two lead positions, the span of control reduces from 6 to 12 direct reports per supervisor. The financial impact for the remaining of this fiscal year, 23-24, including salary and benefits, is approximately $20,293. And we haven't yet filled the position due to the retirement, and that position was budgeted for the entire year. It is estimated that by the time the two supervisor vacancies are filled, the agency could see a savings of up to $27,400. The financial impact to the fiscal year 24-25 budget is expected to be about $22,000, which would be incorporated into the fiscal year 24-25 revised budget. So this recommendation is to approve the revised position control that repurposes two lead positions and replaces them with supervisor positions. And this concludes my report. We also have the Director of Operations and Maintenance, Mike Alvord, virtually to answer any specific questions.
Thank you, Rochelle. Any public comment
No public comment at this time.
Can you open it up for the directors? Questions? Vice President Gutzeit?
Just have a question. Explain the financial considerations again. I understand we have an unfilled position. Some people are retiring. So is there a cost or a savings this year?
For the current year, there would be a savings. Okay. For next year, there would be an additional cost of about $22,000, which we could incorporate into next year's budget. But for this year, we were able to use the savings from the vacancy.
Okay, is that vacancy going to be filled at some point, or is it just...
Well, it would be filled by the two supervisor positions.
Okay, so there's not an additional...
No, there's no additional positions that are being proposed. It's just repurposing two positions we currently have.
That are a little lower in salary than the retiree?
Yes, they would be maybe a senior position that may be ready to take the supervisor position. They're budgeted as potential promotions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I think it's well thought out of how this is being organized, and the staff report just outlines it very clearly what they're proposing, and I agree with that. So with that, the other members agree with that. So we move it on.
Consent?
Consent. Okay, item number 7. Recommend approval of the revised surplus policy. Rochelle, please.
Yes. So our administrative services manager, Kim Grass, will briefly run through the changes that staff is proposing to the surplus policy.
Thank you, Rochelle. Good evening, directors. The surplus policy is a written policy that designates how the agency handles our surplus. Best practices are to regularly review the agency policies. It's been since September 2018 that this policy has been reviewed and updated, so it was time. After reviewing other agencies' policies and conferring with our legal counsel, we are proposing the following changes to the policy. First is to remove all the procedures from the current policy and get just down to clear policy. Additionally, would be to include optional methods of disposal for our vehicles and mobile equipment. Those optional disposal methods are online-based used car retailers, that's very common now, and through leasing partners that we have. And then lastly would be adding an IT surplus property section, which would define how the agency would need to clear off the wipe clean the IT property prior to any disposal or donation. The updates to the policy are in line with our strategic plan objectives to standardize operating procedures and business processes, as well as updating and maintaining clear and comprehensive policies for the agency. We are recommending that the Finance and Administration Committee recommends to the Board of Directors to approve the surplus policy. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Questions of the board, comments? Director Colley.
Just a comment. Having read through the policy, I couldn't find anything objectionable or a significant change that it seems like a major rewrite made the kind of difficult to make sure that it wasn't something new being slipped in, but it doesn't seem to be. And I recommend just be put on consent.
Further comments or questions? Hearing none, I think it will go on consent.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Our next subject. Okay, item number 8, recommend approval of revised ratepayer advocate process and provide direction related to ratepayer advocate service contract. Rochelle, please.
So in November 2018, the Board of Directors approved the ratepayer advocate process as was required in the Agency Act, SB 634. After the approval of the process, staff developed an RFP and performed interviews of the three firms who responded to the RFP. In August 2019, the Board of Directors entered into a contract with Robert D. Niehaus, RDN, to fill the role as the ratepayer advocate. The scope of work with RDN included the 2020 facility capacity fee update, the 2021 cost of service and rate study, and the March 2022 wholesale rate study. The total cost for those studies were approximately $105,000. The contract was extended in order for the ratepayer advocate to review the Valencia service area capacity fee study, but would need to be extended staff needs to be directed to prepare and submit an RFP for ratepayer advocate services going forward. That's pretty much most of my report. There was a couple changes, which I had some comments to about the change of connection fee to retail capacity fee, which it's a discussion. I was just trying to be consistent with facility capacity fee and the new retail capacity fee with Valencia. We just took out a couple sections that doesn't seem like they apply anymore. One had to do with not accepting any ratepayer advocates that would have done business with either of the legacy agencies 3 years prior to the date of this process. And then adding in a section that allows the board to extend a ratepayer advocate contract for 3 additional years. So we're just asking to approve the process with those changes and then get guidance on what the committee would like us to do with renewing the existing contract or to go out for RFP and could end up with the same ratepayer advocate or somebody new. So there's 2 parts to this item.
Thank you, Rochelle. Any public comments?
Yes, we do have public comment today. I have one that was left written by Sandra Cattell. She has left and she has written on the card, absolutely, the agency should retain a ratepayer advocate. And then there were several public comments that I received via email, which I've shared with you.
Yes, okay. Actually, all 4 of them I have in front of me. 2 of them, which was read earlier, the one from Kathleen Walker. She's, I'll just say it again. I am a Valencia resident and wanted to share my support for the water affordability study and also for having a water payer, ratepayer advocate. And then the other one that was read earlier, Sarah Darden, as she said at her closing, that she's in favor of a ratepayer advocate beyond 2023. The other 2 for this item is from received this afternoon is Brooke Singerman. It kind of goes on with a lot of questions, which staff may want to give her a call and talk to her about if she wants answers for. But here it goes. Hello, Erica Dell. Hopefully this helps. Not sure cause I am working here are some things. She kind of admits that she's just kind of typing fast. apologies, I am writing this on a limited time. Hopefully I can make some sense. Anyways, if a requirement was supposed to be made from 2018 for a ratepayer advocate through 2023, was this done and addressed? Yes. This is my first point. My second point, due to several and many shortages over the last few years where the governor and other county city officials, none are terribly sure, made rules, laws, policies due to such shortages. My question is, where were these shortages exactly coming from? Who or whom were they coming from? The challenge Santa Clarita has had to face was certain days of the week to use certain water systems, sprinklers to go off at certain time, nozzles to be put on hoses. Families and neighbors are fine if they did not follow the water regulations. Does the water or the lack of water for the summer, where people buy tons of water bottles and sparklets, comes twice the amount of times along with other water companies? That's a question. With these interesting points and hopefully grammatically correct, I was wondering if a ratepayer advocate was and is necessary. The answer is yes. So she got to the point. So they can audit the costs. That way, plenty water to go around at a reasonable cost. Brooke.
Okay.
And this last one is from Steve Reese. It's spelled R-E-I-S-E. Caution, this email originated from outside the organization. I have to read that, I guess. But I'll continue on. The Finance and Administration Committee members today can decide whether or not to continue to have a ratepayer advocate past 2023. If you think it's beneficial to customers to have a ratepayer advocate, it would be helpful to have statements of support at today's committee meeting. Yes, I am full support of the ratepayer advocate past 2023. There is no downside to this. Thank you, Steve Reese.
Chairman Peterson, I think you have one more comment there. If not, I can read it very quickly. It's from Susie Rizzo.
Oh, I don't see that one. Go ahead, Erica.
It's very short. Yeah. This was received at 4:37 p.m. today from Susie Rizzo, and it says, I support having a ratepayer advocate. Please approve. And then she leaves her name and address.
Thank you.
And that's all we have right now.
I just want to clarify, we're not asking to not have the ratepayer advocate. We're just asking how we should move forward with a contract with a ratepayer advocate.
Yes, I understand. With that, Director Cawley.
So I don't think that the item precludes me from expressing my views on having a ratepayer advocate. So I'm going to do exactly that. So we've had a ratepayer advocate for about 4 years. I first want to say that 5 years ago, I suggested, and many times since, that I think that my job here on the board is better described as ratepayer advocate than director. We staff and the board need to be the advocate and should be, and I think most of us feel that we are advocates for the ratepayer. So in the last 4 years, I have not seen a single instance of someone saying that they're a ratepayer advocate suggesting any overall savings of any money at all. I haven't seen anything from the ratepayer advocate other than discussions of, I guess most of the discussions are just simply, you know, who should pay what part of the overall bill. So rate studies do that, and staff recommends and had recommended for the 20 years before that from the Castaic board And the board approved or disapproved of the allocation of the budget. But unless we actually had, well, there was a public comment there that one of the, that the ratepayer advocate would audit. I think that was the word. Is that the word in that particular comment? Yeah. So I haven't seen the ratepayer advocate audit anything. I just haven't seen that the ratepayer advocate has helped our ratepayers pay less money overall. And while it sounds like a really cool title, and I know that there's at the Public Utilities Commission, there are there's an office called the Ratepayer Advocate, and that Ratepayer Advocate in that office has, as part of its function, trying to figure out the allocation of expenses between the owners of the utility and the public. Here, we don't have any owners of the utility to pass expenses on to. We don't profit. We don't, you know, the only place we get money is from the ratepayers. And so the way we can advocate for them is by saving money. And I'll kind of conclude that we save money by not paying somebody to say they're a ratepayer advocate, and for staff and us to do our job and advocate for the ratepayer. So I'd like to see us sunset the ratepayer advocate as soon as possible. Thank you.
I actually copied and pasted the language from SB 634 because I figured it might come up. So the board of directors shall not eliminate the ratepayer advocate role before January 1st of 2023. On or after January 1st, 2023, the board of directors may eliminate the ratepayer advocate role with an affirmative vote of 4/5 of its membership. On or after January 1st, 2025, the board of directors may at any time dispense with a 4/5 vote required for any action described in the subdivision A and B by majority vote of the membership of the board. So to eliminate the, or sunset, to eliminate the ratepayer advocate, it would take a 4/5 majority vote at this point. After January 1st of 2025, it would be a majority vote. I don't know if that helps.
Thank you. Vice President Gutzeit, please.
Yeah, Director Colley was here and I was here when we heard this process. It was actually proposed by Director DiPremio, I think, and heard extensively at Finance. We talked about it a lot at the Finance Committee. Couple clarifications, at least, you know, from what I heard back then, it wasn't so much about saving money, although it was more about understanding of the issues and checking for best management practices. I will say that there's a potential for a rate consultant to have some kind of ownership for what they're proposing as being the best approach, obviously, because they're proposing it. They would propose what they think is best. But this advocate, of the people that we interviewed, you know, has broad experience in rate setting and could compare what other areas do and chime in and say, well, another thing you might consider for this fee would be doing it this way. Also, what we were looking for in a ratepayer advocate was the ability to clarify to the public or stakeholders. So this may be people like the stakeholders involved in the Valencia Water fee setting process, and certainly many stakeholders back in the facility capacity fee setting process seemed frustrated that either they weren't being heard or they didn't understand what was going on. And we were seeking a ratepayer advocate who seemed to have skill in clarifying things into plain language for them and also being available as a resource for both stakeholders and public, if they called up and said, I don't understand why my bill is changing, this is ridiculous, it costs too much, the advocate could, you know, provide them with information. That in terms of costs, honestly, somebody's going to answer that person's question. So it's either going to be our rate consultant or our staff. So somebody's going to spend time answering the questions. And I think the thought was it was somebody that didn't have ownership of what was already proposed. And also, yes, I'll agree with you a little bit or a lot in that we are advocates for the public and the ratepayers, but we don't know as much as somebody that specializes in it. So this position was to be a resource to the directors and report to the directors, not to the staff. So again, we could get a second opinion, like, is this realistic? Do most water agencies borrow this much money? And is this the appropriate percentage of household income? This person is available to us to ask that question and should have some broad background. So that's where it came from. I'm in favor of continuing it. I guess since I just gave my little speech about wanting competitive bids, I will chime in and say that I would like some cost checking on this. I am pleased with what RDN has done. I saw them in some of these processes. I thought they gave good input. And all I remember was Monte Carlo scheme, but there was some Monte Carlo something going on with the facility capacity fee, and they were explaining and discussing it with you in great detail. And they also provided, I thought, good counterpoint on the Valencia fee issue. They brought up things that I wouldn't have thought of and worked with the other consultant to resolve it and tell us how it was resolved. So I thought that was good service. So I'm in favor of it. I believe, to be consistent with my cost savings pitch I just had, that it should be competitively bid when we can.
Thank you, Vice President Kutsite. Director Armitage.
Thank you. So yes, so thank you, Ms. Patterson, for the information. Thank you to the members of the public who took the time to share their thoughts with us. I'll share my perspective in my time since I've joined this board in 2021. I feel like I've been able to witness how the ratepayer advocate has provided input in three out of the four ways that was listed in our memo. And I feel like each of those times I have appreciated kind of their third party perspective and the input that they gave on processes, because as Vice President Gutzeit mentioned, I'm not an expert in these processes by any means. And so it was nice to lean on somebody from outside the agency who doesn't have a stake and offer their opinion on those types of processes. So I've appreciated leaning on that. Let's see what else. I appreciate also, as Vice President Gutzeit mentioned, that it gives us board members and also the public another resource to use to sit down and get further explanation if they need it on why the rate structure is the way that it is. And I think it adds a added layer of transparency that I think brings value as well. So let's see, I'll skip through this. I think the revisions of the attachment are fine, and I agree. I think that we should put their RFP out to bid as well, just to get a sense of other options and checking the costs and things like that as well. So thank you.
Thank you. You know, I've only been on the board for a year, but have had many years' experiences with the ratepayer, the PUC process, and what I've seen in the year of working or listening to board presentations by the staff and looking at the work that was done on the Valencia connection fee or retail connection fee. I have to be careful what I say. And I see Nienhaus did a fine job in working, looking at various alternatives. And that's what their primary profession is. And I've seen them work with other water agencies in Orange County and working and doing a very fine job and analysis and directing the staffs of those agencies and developing a rate structure that would be compatible for the goals of the agency involved. So I'm sure that Niehaus will do a fine job still, but it is hearing both on my sides here that we should go out for an RFP using the scope of work that was provided to us by the staff here. So that's where I think the direction is, Rochelle, from the committee tonight. Go ahead, Vice President.
Sorry, just a couple of thoughts. I agree with Director Armitage, and that's a very good way to put it as far as the third party look. I also think it is reassuring to the public that we have multiple experts agreeing with things that affect our pocketbook. And then on cost, I want to clarify that we were looking at cost and ability. So I remember the presentation with RDN, and they were clearly just, they understood the scope. They were a great presenter. I want, you know, both the cost check and that they're going to be good to work with. So as with some of our engineering contracts or other professional services, that may not necessarily be the lowest price, but we want the best price and best consultant we can get for the money. So, and then lastly, I will mention, I was one that was confused by the naming conventions on the different fees. That remains something that I would like to see clarified, so everybody knows when we say facility capacity fees, they know what it is. When somebody says retail connection, at New Hall, we call it connection fees. When somebody says retail connection fee, retail capacity fee, connection fee, whatever we want to call it, that it's clear what it is and across all documents. So, you know, if it's this thing, it covers this stuff. If it's this other thing, it covers this other stuff. Because it still isn't that clear to me, but I don't really care what we settle on as long as it's consistent and clear.
So I we'll make those adjustments. We can do a definition. We can, there's some renumbering that we said that we would do in the policy or the process. So if everyone is okay with that, is it something we can put on consent? Because we'll need that updated process in order to go out for the RFP.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Any objections? None?
So can I ask a question?
Ahead. Yeah.
So if we go out for an RFP, how long will we be locked into a contract, and compare that to the 2025 possibility that a majority of the board might want to end this process?
Well, it says up to 3 years, so I'm assuming you could do a 2-year contract. Or we had it, even though the current contract, we had extended it for the Valencia capacity fee, it was more project driven. So it was based on the projects that we had in the RFP. We wanted them to do the facility capacity fees, the rate study, and the wholesale water rate. Those were the three fees. And once those were done, that work had kind of ended until the Valencia capacity fee study came up. So we can either do it by time or by project. But I mean, if we're our next potential cost of service and rate study would be effective July 1st of 2025, based on scenario 3A, that the ratepayer advocate would have to start. Or I guess if we didn't have a ratepayer advocate, I guess we wouldn't need one because we would start working and having public meetings early.
Remind me that date in 2025.
July 1st, 2025 is when it would be effective.
No, right. The date that the
January 1st, 2025.
So just a little over a year from now, the majority of the board could decide. Okay.
We may have a agency-wide capacity fee study, so the ratepayer advocate could be part of that in that time frame.
And we're still working on the Valencia question. Is it correct?
Yeah, that should be coming back. Okay. I'll just note too that there's, you know, as you saw the CIP numbers, One of the things I'm curious about is, do we have that ground into our regional facility capacity fee assumptions? We also have one WASA water service area in our FCF study that was for the Whitaker, former Whitaker Burmite property. There is now a 6,500 dwelling unit, 10,000 seat amphitheater, X amount of commercial property proposal that's been submitted to the city for that property. So we will be needing to look at what the infrastructure requirements would be there, and we will need to be addressing a facility capacity fee for that WASA, or integrate it with other WASAs and do a general update. So there is the potential to need ratepayer advocate services before 2025 for the retail rates. I would say a relatively high potential. And so I would say we should move forward with an RFP, so that we have, we're not, that isn't the holdup. Thanks.
Can I, would it be helpful to get some kind of a sense of the board as a whole on whether or not on the 1st of January, the board was going to have the appetite to eliminate this process or this function? Because I think that.
I think the problem, Director Colley, is you have an election between now and then, so you would be making a decision for that board.
Okay, I understand.
And I know you don't like to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay.
Yeah, from a practical standpoint, we have to wait till we get there and see. And it's conceivable there may be enough value there that the board wants to continue with something, maybe not quite the same thing. Or
I'm just trying to figure out how to not lock in a future board.
Oh, I think we can write the contract in such a way. Most of our consultant contracts have a termination clause.
Okay.
So right. That's not a problem.
All right. Thank you.
Director Kathy.
It's okay. one more question. Since this is a little bit different because the board selects the ratepayer advocate, correct? So how, because normally staff does all the work for us and brings us a recommendation that we approve or don't approve. So can you tell me a little bit about the process of how that person would get selected or the group would be selected?
Well, I can tell you what we did last time. It was the Finance Administration Committee that did interviews with the companies that proposed. And they had the list of questions and the committee decided.
Yeah, and that's kind of consistent. I know when we did our federal legislative advocate, we used that approach. The Public Outreach Committee did interviews and made a recommendation. So for those ones where it's kind of a pretty either directly working for the board or heavily board adjacent, you know, that's one of those occasional functions that the committees get to do. So
okay.
And staff try to facilitate that process.
Any further? No, nothing. Okay. We move on to the next item, which is recommend receiving and filing of the June 2023 monthly and the fiscal year 2022/23 fourth quarter financial report, the end of the year report.
Yes. So just note, it says it very small, I believe. It's unaudited. This is through period 12. Does not include period 13 or 14 adjustments for accruals or any audit adjustments. So this is just through period 12 since we have not yet closed fiscal year 23. Next slide. And I'm not going to read all these. They're in your packet. They're just some of our highlights from the last quarter. Next slide. These are our total revenues. Our total water sales year to date through June of 2023 were $81.3 million, which is a reduction of 12%. That's about $11.4 million compared to the budget of $92.7 million. Later on in the report, we'll see our expenses were under budget by $9.7 million. So not quite one for one, but our expenses were lower as well as our revenues. Actual water sales were lower than budgeted based on some conservation efforts, we believe, slower growth than projected, and weather patterns. And the agency, of course, was received more than 34 inches of rainfall, not in, this is through June, not including yesterday, since the beginning of fiscal year. Overall, in fiscal year 22-23, total revenues through June 23, that's operating and non-operating, of $132 million, we're about 11%, about 16% under budget of the $148.4 million. Next slide. And just looking at the water sales, total water produced for retail consumption from April through June was 13,760 acre feet, comprised of 3,532 acre feet of groundwater and 10,228 acre feet of surface water. Year-to-date total water consumption was 49,822 acre feet as compared to the budget projection of 58,940, which is a direct correlation to our reduced water sale revenues. Next slide. And looking at our water sale revenue by customer class, our residential water sales were under budget by 6%, about $2.8 million. Our commercial water sales were over budget by 15% of $748,000. Our landscaping irrigation water sales was the biggest number, 38% under budget, $7.3 million. Those are mostly the city parks, landscaping, medians. All other water sales were under budget by 12%, about $1.3 million. Our total number of billing connections added through June 2023 for the fiscal year was 766 out of the 1,550 projected for the year. Next slide. Our property tax, we actually estimated pretty close. We received about $31.6 million out of our $30.2 million. Budget for our 1% property tax revenue. Next slide. And on our facility capacity fee, your retail capacity fee, received were about 3.6, almost 3.7 million. On the regional facility capacity fees, we collected about 3.4 million and 311,000 in the retail capacity fees out of a budget of 6.3 million. Next slide. This again just shows the developments of where we those capacity fees have been collected. So about 300 year to date number of connections. Next slide. So our other revenues that it is takes into account our 1% property taxes, which we talked about. Those are in the blue bar. The facility capacity fees in orange, which was on the previous slide. And the green section is other miscellaneous revenues, and that includes grants, reimbursements, sale, lease, rental income, and investment revenues. We received about $15.5 million, approximately 19% under budget of the $19.2 million. One of the reasons why it was a little bit less is we haven't received all of the grant revenue that we have expected. We have maybe about $1.4 million that had been accrued. So that number could be more for the end of the year. But rest assured, we haven't lost that grant revenue that will roll into next year when those projects are completed. Next slide. Not sure that I need to go through the investment portfolio. We already had the presentation from Chandler, so we can go ahead and skip this page. On the capital program, so in general, the expenditures for CIP projects depend on bid timing, contract awards, coordination with other agencies, coordination with other projects, staffing levels, and other such factors. The fiscal year 23 PAYGO budget for capital improvement program was $75.8 million. Of that, 34% or $25.9 million in funds have been expended. For fiscal year 2023 debt funded on the right-hand side, the CIP expenditures, the budget was about $41.9 million, and of that amount, about 41.5% or 17.4% funds have been expended. We also have about $10.3 million in committed costs, so those still may be charged to fiscal year 23, but those have been requisitioned for. Next slide. On our operating expenditures, overall fiscal year 23 operating expenditures of $84.4 million were under budget by about 10%. That's about almost $9.7 million of the $94 million budget. Some of the significant activities were in the water quality treatment and maintenance category. That was over budget by about 11%, $1.3 million, primarily due to treatment plant power cost and regulatory fees. In water resources, we were under budget by 19%, about $1.8 million, primarily due to conservation program expenses being less than expected due to lower program participation. That typically happens in a wet year. And in source of supply, we're under budget by about 19%. That's $2.4 million as a result of lower firming banking program expenditures driven also by a wet year. Next slide. So this is the debt service as of, and the principal outstanding as of June. So this will be updated with our new principal amount in August when we do this report. But our year-to-date payments for fiscal year 23 were $33,214,000. The principal debt outstanding as of June was $261,195,000. Next slide. For our cash position on the left-hand side, our restricted and unrestricted cash, we had about $58 million in unrestricted cash. That is to meet the agency's payment obligations, such as operating expenses, including debt service, payroll expenses, insurance, the CIP PAYGO, and then about $114 million in our reserves and about $112 million in restricted cash. And the restricted cash, which includes the facility retail capacity fee funds, state water project fund, and any remaining bond proceeds, which we have expended all of our 2020A bond proceeds in advance of the 2023 bond funding. Next slide. And then just the other components of the financial package, the statement of revenues and expenditures for the month of June, I should say June, investment report, three-month cash flow, debt and cash position, facility capacity revenues, just some additional graphs, the 10 largest disbursements of the check register, the credit card register, director stipends, and director reimbursements. And then next slide. That the recommendation is that the Finance Administration Committee recommend the Board of Directors receive and file the June 2023 monthly and fiscal year 2022 fourth quarter financial report. And that concludes my report.
Thank you, Rochelle. Any public comment, Erica?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Any questions, comments from the board? Vice President Gutzeit?
Okay. Thank you. Just one question, and I think this speaks to what Director Peterson was talking about. On slide 11, with the big gap between CIP budget and CIP actual, is that, this is closed, so that gap's not going to resolve, or could it?
No, it won't resolve, but we already anticipated that in the fiscal year 23-24 budget. Mm-hmm. We anticipated a significant amount, 46 million-ish, rolling over into the next fiscal year.
Okay, but that speaks to what you're talking about. Like, we plan stuff and then it just has issues sometimes. Yeah, it's a lot of moving parts. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Director Ambertrage.
Thanks. Just, I always wonder this, and I don't ask, and so I'm just going to ask. So with the significantly lower connection fees, or the connection fees that we, that shows that we haven't collected what we expected, and I'm just trying to get an idea of how concerned we should continue to be on that. So clarifying question for me, so I can understand that. When the connection fees are lower than projected, is this a situation where the agency is currently expending funds because of that, but it's not being, they're not being collected? Or is it that the infrastructure is there and ready to provide water, but the service hasn't started yet?
So when there's a correlation between the timing of the facility capacity fees when they come in, or the connection fees, and when they become a customer. So when we talk about the 311 of kind of number of capacity fees we received. Those may or may not have been installed yet, but because we've added 700 customers already this year, those were probably from fees collected in the prior year, because it does take a while for homes to be built after they pay their fees. When it comes to the revenue, we do have anticipated our future revenues to be a little bit lower based on what we know of the economic climate and the housing market not being as strong as it was, you know, a couple of years ago. But the way the facility capacity fees are, the plan that was approved is that even though we have low years of receipts, the full amount will be collected at build out. So if we don't get them this year, we may get them next year, we may get them 5 years from now. And that is meant to offset a portion of the debt that was made, that was incurred for the growth or extra capacity of those projects that were installed. So even though we may not receive them today, the way that the facility capacity fee study was developed is that with a 85% confidence level, I think it was, that by at build out, we will have collected all of the debt service we needed to construct those projects. So I don't know if that helped.
Can I expand on that a little bit too? So the capacity fees are actually paid for when the developers pull a building permit. So that's the time period. Typically takes 3 to 4 months, sometimes even 6 months to build a home, depending on the same construction issues that we have, rain, other factors, availability of supplies. And so we get our estimates are based off of our current best available knowledge from the developers. We get their phasing schedule and number of units they anticipate selling or building in that window. And we try to back that out by that same 4 to 6 months, depending on the developer. Some build homes faster if you're dealing with a multifamily type development, or slower if you're doing the single family. So we're just doing the same guesstimate that we are trying to get as close as possible to an accurate number of capacity fees collected. But as Rochelle pointed out, those fees are not lost. They will be collected eventually. The capacity, as far as whether or not we built CIP projects, there is some expense that goes on to build. If we are, say, contributing to a tank where we have the participation that may serve that, that is some expenditure that is anticipated recapturing by the time the development is built out.
Thank you. I feel like I still need to sit down and have more of a one-on-one with somebody to really kind of understand the whole connection fee world. But thank you for that.
Can I follow up on that?
Go ahead.
See, I'm going to second that, because this is what I'm talking about. Like, we need a drawing or something. And I mean, I just think it would be easier to understand the timing and all of that. And when you said, just to be clear, one thing I want to check, but I appreciate the detail. If we are building something that then when they build, they're going to pay us back part of it. So let's say they owe us 30% of a tank or something, but they take a while to build their project. Do we charge interest when we put up that tank? Like, if they owe us 30% and they don't pay us today, they pay us their 30% in 2 years. Are we getting interest because we oversized our tank and they didn't build right away?
We have an increase in our capacity fees based off of ENR.
ENR.
Engineering News Record, okay. Construction Cost so Index. So there is an increase in the capacity fee that occurs annually,
okay,
to offset the cost if we would have done that.
Okay.
So yeah, they will be paying more by delaying their capacity fees, and we won't let them pay early.
Okay.
So you can't pay your capacity fees until you're ready for your building permits.
Okay. Good point. Okay. Thank you for explaining that. But I do think, like,
we have spreadsheets and
some graphic.
General Manager Stone has recommended at E&O committee that we bring forward the that representation of how many anticipated meters we have and when they're getting set, because there's a discrepancy there. We aren't actually collecting rates for that either. We pay capacity fees and then the meter doesn't get set for another 4 months or 5 months, and then the home doesn't get occupied until 6 months or something along those lines.
So yeah, timing is an issue, and also just what fee covers what and how long do we pay it for. I have faith that we get it all eventually, but I think it's confusing.
Director Colley, please.
This kind of relates to a topic I've brought up a couple of times. Historically, we used to track the interest, and when we were tracking it, the number got to be really, really big. And then all of a sudden, it just sort of got, I don't know, washed away. And I've asked multiple times to get some kind of a understanding of what happened to it and are we collecting it. I'm not sure that the current argument that the escalation of the fee using the ENR, which, as I understood it last time we discussed this, that was to account for the fact that in the future, building things will cost more. And so to the extent that a fee is forward-looking, that ENR was the argument for using that. I don't think I've ever heard before an argument that it was going to compensate us for past expenses and the interest that we've incurred on that debt. So this is a new argument to me. And again, I kind of renewing, and I know we're probably a little off.
Yeah.
Never land, but I'd like to renew. I think all of us would like to renew that request to have that discussion of facility capacity fee and what happened to that interest and other things.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure that was Director Gutzeit's hypothetical, so that may be why it's not the right answer. But I was just going to add that there is quite a bit of infrastructure that's actually put in by the developer directly that costs us nothing and we incur no debt on. Yeah. And, you know, one strategy may be to push a little more for more of that on situations that are ambiguous. Maybe the assumption should be they're going to put it in, and if they want to get reimbursed and wait for the money back, they can do that. That takes us out of the position of being the financier. So if we're looking at fiscal restraint, that might be something to look at.
Yeah. I will not jump into this discussion. Only because I have my own thoughts about the whole matter after all these years of being in the collecting those Santa fees and watching systems being built. So with that, anything other to add to the discussion here on the Shall we put this on the consent calendar?
I usually, on the quarterly report, I usually present to the board.
That's all right.
Sorry, you have to listen to it a second time.
You have to lead you into it. with that, we'll move on to item 10, which is the planning calendar. Rochelle, please.
Yeah. So next month's meeting is delayed by 1 week. So September 25th is the meeting, and we did not have anything on our calendar in October. So we had proposed to cancel the October meeting. We don't have any financials because we're at that point working on all of our audit work, and those will be delayed. So we'll be presenting 2 months in November. So we will be bringing back the ground lease agreement for the Action Family Recovery Center. We've been working on that. We will be bringing back our investment policy. It just has a couple changes to it. We do that annually. It's required. We had talked about already bringing forward a revised customer service policy because of a change of workflow and adding a fee for setting temporary meters rather than having engineering do it and holding the deposit. It will all be handled through the customer accounts. We anticipate a fleet and warehouse update, just a quarterly update. I'm not sure if we're ready for this for a purchase order. We had talked about the electric vehicles and the new regulations coming in effective January, and we would have an opportunity not accept delivery, but so long as we had a purchase order for a certain number of gas powered vehicles, we can get in before the regulation, and that will give us an opportunity to, get electric vehicles as they become available, especially for heavier duty equipment, and then also provide us time to put in the infrastructure for those electric vehicles. So whether it's in September or November, coming to you for approve a purchase order for a unknown number of gas powered vehicles at this time, November. We have also working with Terra Verde, who is working with our solar panels as well, and to help us do some of that. That knowledge that we need for what vehicles should be replaced and maybe where the equipment needs to be placed, and doing a study for us. And that's all we have in September.
That's all, folks. Any public comment, Erica?
No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Any comments from the board members? None from us. Thank you, Rochelle. Moving on to requests for future agenda items from the board. Oh, yes, Director Armitage.
So when we had our discussion about the purchasing policy, and we kind of went round and round on the word inventory being included, and then I felt really bad for having it pulled out because that was not my intention. I was hoping we could find some additional language to add to that. That we were all comfortable with. So I'm wondering if we can give some thought to, you were mentioning Mr. Stone perhaps having a pre-purchasing policy or some other way to address that issue that was separate from the purchasing policy.
Yeah, I think we kind of parsed through the issue more in our executive staff meeting, and I believe we have a solution that's in the works. That's, we realized the problem is a little different too, in a good way. So I think we have a workable set of solutions. I couldn't even describe them to you off the cuff, but we did. This is like 3 minutes ago. We parsed through that, and Rochelle, I think, is working on some language
for a proposed policy.
Just in addition to the policy, you would just lay out some different requirements if the requirements were met for inventory itself, similar to like what we did for the PFAS. Resin changeouts. We had some different rules for that, so we could provide some different rules for inventory. It's not at the top of our list today. So,
yeah, it was just rather than try to squeeze it into that section of the policy, we realized we should just write a section that clearly describes that situation and how it should, if the board agrees, how it should be handled.
In the purchasing policy?
Yes.
Okay. And is Mr. Albert happy with it?
So actually, it was a good thing. I know you feel bad about it.
I did. That's what I'm asking. Is Mr. Albert happy with that?
I think he's working with it.
He's working with it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for that follow up.
All right. Anything else? Nothing else? Okay. Item 12, general report on finance and administration activities.
Just a couple things. I wanted to let the committee know that we received the Excellence in Financial Reporting Award from GFOA for our fiscal year 2022, ACFR. Erica worked very, very hard. She has already sent our fiscal year 23-24, 24-25 budget to GFOA to be considered for the award program for budget excellence. So 6 months from now, we might hear if we receive that award. Mm-hmm. And then just the one other thing, I think last time I read, we have about 230 customers enrolled in the ratepayer assistance program. All right. That's all I have.
Can you briefly say anything about Actions Lease?
Yes. So we are recommending a 5-year lease with options to extend for 5 additional years, 1 year at a time. We talked about the rent, and we talked about it here, maintaining the current lease amount that they're paying now for the first year. And then it will just increase at the rate that was in the existing contract. I can't remember if it was 3% or 5%, but it was, we're not talking about a new contract. It will just be an amendment to extend the lease term. Okay. And they are, it's positive from the Action Family Counseling Center.
Any questions, any comments from the public?
No public comment at this time.
All right, well, reached item number. Oh, I'm sorry. Director Almatron.
Thank you. Just really quickly, congratulations. I know you're saying it's getting boring, Director Colley, but I think we should still say congratulations to the entire finance team for the award on excellence. It is nice to continue to hear it.
Thank Amy back there.
Amy, yay.
Yeah. Yeah. And Doreen works on the statistical section. So it is a team effort, but it is a big lift by accounting.
Yeah. And a lot of hours, I'm sure, go into it. So thank you. Thank you to both of you and anyone else ancillarily involved in that as well. So, and then just in terms of the ratepayer assistance program, from a conversation I had very recently, it sounded to me like there was opportunity for improvement in outreach to the Veterans Collaborative or the veterans groups. So I just wanted to put that out there if we can.
Yeah, I know Kathleen has reached out to them. Okay. With the gentleman that was here when we talked about the pilot program, she reached out, he gave her his card, and she gave him all of the information and applications and everything she needed.
Okay, well then maybe the person I spoke with didn't realize that. So. Okay, thank you.
Anything? All right. Well, item 13 is adjournment of the meeting. No. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.